Well, as always, it's good to see everybody back for the evening worship. We are going to consider a topic that continues to be of interest to Christians and unbelievers alike, and that is the age of the earth. I suppose have your Bibles up in Genesis chapter 1. We're not going to look at that just yet, but we are going to notice some things out of Genesis 1 throughout the lesson, some things about the 6 days of creation and God resting on the seventh day. If we are to listen to some of the claims of science today, the present estimate for the age of the earth by most in the scientific community is around 4.5 billion years old, with the age of the universe being somewhere between 8 and 12 billion years old. Of course, we need to remember some things about these numbers, is that every single generation, these numbers seem to change. Only 50 years ago, the age of the universe was supposedly only 2 billion years. Between then and now, the scientific community almost unanimously declared the age to be 30 billion years. And of course, now it's been reduced to less than half of that. And it reminds me a little bit of what was said in the book of Romans. In Romans chapter 3 and verse 4, "Let God be found true, though every man be found a liar." Of course, I would never say that if somebody was to believe that the universe or the earth was a certain number of years old and then they were to change that 10 years later or 20 years later or however long it were to take, I'm not saying that person was overtly lying the first guess that they had. I'm not saying they were lying 50 years ago when they said the universe was such and such billion years old and that they're lying now on purpose or anything. But I think it's just a good reminder that you can't trust the words of men as they stand alone. That every generation of human beings is going to have their truths that they believe to be truths at the time. And 50 years from that point, those truths are going to be flipped upside down on their heads. And 50 years after that, people will be revisiting those old truths once again. Truth is flexible in the mind of man. And I just love what it said there, that let God be found true, though every man be found a liar. Even when all the scientific community seems to change its mind every generation or so about the age of the universe and the age of the earth, God is true. And God's truth never changes. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 20 gives us another reminder in our search for knowledge and understanding knowledge. Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, verse 20, that we should avoid the opposing arguments of what is falsely called knowledge. Don't foist upon me what is only a theory and call it knowledge. Don't call something truth or fact when in fact it cannot be proven by the scientific method at all. Something is a theory. Call it a theory. Don't call something that's fact. Now, don't call something that's merely a theory a fact. We need to avoid the opposing arguments of things that are falsely called knowledge. You know, flatly contradicting these scientific or supposedly scientific claims is a literal interpretation of the Bible, which is where you get into Genesis chapter 1. If you look at a literal interpretation of the Bible, then the age of the earth really can't be a whole lot more than 10,000 years at the most. If you believe, which I think is reasonable to believe, that there are gaps in the genealogies in the book of Genesis and the First Chronicles, if you were to believe that there are at least a few gaps in that genealogy, which again is reasonable, you can push the age of the earth by a literal interpretation of the Bible to perhaps 13,000 years. Wait a minute, hold on. Anybody listening on the internet there, right? Anybody watching on the internet going, okay, hold on a second. I took biology 101, okay? Hold on a minute, hold on. I took my general ed classes. You're telling me, Christian, that the earth is 10,000 years old, and you're expecting Christians then to be a reasonable and respectable and credible group of people in our country. Is it reasonable or is it ridiculous to assert that the earth could be merely 10,000 years old and not 4.5 billion years old? Is it absolutely unscientific? Keep in mind, as we consider a few things here, keep in mind that there are over 68 ways, methods, that scientists date fossils. There are over 68 methods of figuring out the age of the Earth. There are over 68 methods of geological, astronomical, and biological methods of trying to determine the age of extremely ancient things. And I will guarantee you that those 68 methods of dating things and dating the age of the Earth are in absolute, complete disagreement. Not a single one gives the exact same age for something. Not a single one gives the exact same age for the Earth itself, for a rock or a geological structure or a biological entity. Almost all of them, in fact, can be used and can be interpreted in such a way to show that it is reasonable scientifically to show that the Earth is, in fact, around 10,000 years old. And if this is so, why don't we hear numbers like this all the time? If it is so that it is scientifically tenable to say that the Earth is 10,000 years old, how come we don't hear that in our culture? How come we don't hear that in our science classes in school? How come our kids don't hear it from the earliest ages on through high school and college? How come we don't hear these things claimed in even pop culture? And the reason is that in order for Darwinian evolution to be true, incomprehensible spans of time are absolutely necessary. A process like Darwinian evolution that is unbelievable by itself can be almost believable if you stretch it out to ridiculous amounts of time. You know, I wonder, what really is more ridiculous? Claiming that the Earth is 10,000 years old, a number that is already too big for us to comprehend, or claiming that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, a number that is so far beyond our comprehension that I think it almost becomes comical. It almost becomes comical to hear people talk about the hundreds of millions and billions of years that things have existed. You can't even comprehend 1,000 years. You have no way in your limited ability, in your limited scope, to even understand 100 years. Are any of us even going to live to be 100 years? Here's something that somebody told me one time. When you think about gigantic numbers, I always thought this is a really good way of thinking about it. If I was to ask you, how much space would it take up, or how big of a box would it require to hold 100 footballs? You would probably be able to comprehend in your mind what a box of 100 footballs might look like. You'd be able to conceptualize that idea. What if I said 1,000 footballs? How big of a box would you require to fit 1,000 footballs? Or how much of this auditorium would it take for 1,000 footballs? Some of us might be able to conceptualize what 1,000 footballs look like. But what if I were to say, tell me, how big, how much space, how big of a room, how big of a box would you require for 10 million footballs? There's only so much that the human brain can actually conceptualize. And that's the thing about Darwinian evolution, is you have to take numbers that are beyond practical conceptualization in order for Darwinian evolution to actually work, or to at least claim that it works. So is a literal interpretation of the days of Genesis even remotely scientifically valid? And what are we to make of some professed believers who accommodate evolutionary thinking on the age of the earth when they look at the first chapter of the Bible? Can there be a compromise? Well, the first question I would ask is, why do you need to compromise? What is driving a person to seek compromise when it comes to claims of pseudoscience versus what the Bible literally says about Earth's origins? One writer put it really well in a book called Studies in Genesis 1. Edward Young says, "It is of course true that the Bible is not a textbook on science." And I think that's important to remember. Don't try to force the Bible to say something that it doesn't actually say. Don't turn over every stone and every rock in the Bible looking for little clues about geology and hydrology. Don't force the Bible to say something that it doesn't actually say. And yet he goes on to say, but all too often, it would seem, this fact is made a pretext for treating lightly the context of Genesis 1. Inasmuch as the Bible is the Word of God, whenever it speaks on any subject, whatever that subject may be, it is accurate in what it says. I think that's a really good point. Let's not force the Bible to confirm or deny one scientific theory or another. That wasn't its intention. But where the Bible does speak on something, it is always factual and it is always accurate because God is the one who wrote it. So Genesis 1, I think, would be a perfect example. I think one way that you can see it is in the popularly termed the day-age theory, where Christians try to somehow synthesize the idea of great spans of time in Earth's origins and the story of Genesis 1 and the 6 days of creation. One writer said, according to this theory, each creation day is supposedly answerable to a geological age represented in the various layers of the crust of the earth. Therefore, the days of Genesis 1, the first day that God said one thing, the second day and the third day, etc., and how God created a distinctive structure on each and every day, each of those days then are symbolic of some kind of great era in ancient and extreme ancient history. The first day represents the forming of the foundational substances in billions of years. The second day represents our atmosphere forming over another billion years or so. The third day represents the most basic non-sentient life forms evolving. The fourth day, etc., etc. And you can see the way a person might take the model of Genesis 1 and build their own symbolic structure around it of these billion-year epochs and how to fit science somehow into the Bible, or the Bible somehow into science. And as evidence for this interpretation, some folks would actually point to the word day in the Hebrew, yom, and claim that it is sometimes used to refer to long periods of time. And yet, I think that when you really look at the word, the way the word yom is used in every context, beyond just selected examples of it, the great majority of the time the word yom is used literally of just a 24-hour day. It's used of just a 24-hour day. Especially in the language of Genesis 1, it's hard to see symbolism there when after every single day, God clearly says, there was morning, there was evening, one day. To me, it's just hard to fit a billion years into the language of there was morning, there was evening, one day. I can't see it myself. No matter how much you might symbolize it or allegorize it, I just don't think that that language can be stretched far enough to fit billions of years into the days of Genesis 1. Notice that in Genesis 2 and verse 2, it doesn't say that God rests, but that he rested on that day. I think that's an important point to bring out. Because if the days of Genesis 1 are billion-year time periods, or however long you want to make it, then that means on the seventh day, God rested. Are we in the seventh day now? Because that's, I think, what you'd have to do if you're going to symbolize the whole thing, is say, well, each day represents billions of years, and now we're in the seventh day, and it said God rested on the seventh day. Are we in the seventh day? Does that mean that God is resting now? Because that's kind of one of those implications that is hard to accept. Are we in the middle of the seventh billion year day right now? Because if that's the case, God is resting. And I don't know. I think there's plenty of other verses in the Bible that say that God is not currently resting. He rested on the seventh day, and at the end of the seventh day, God moved on and continued some kind of activity in this creation. But let's kind of move on to another idea here for the sake of time. The lifespan of Adam. You know, I always wonder about that. are the days of Genesis really million or billion year time periods? What do you do then on the sixth day? What do you do then when it says that man was created on the sixth day? Is that man not Adam? Again, those are the implications that a Christian who wants to synthesize evolutionary thinking in Genesis 1, you have to accept then, was that man on day six, was he not Adam? Then was Adam not the first man? Because that's what you have to accept. Either Adam lived to be billions of years old and not 900 or so years old, or the first man who was created was not, in fact, Adam. Those are just some things. They just don't fit. It just doesn't fit to try and turn these days into long billion-year ages. The Bible and evolutionary thinking on the Earth's age are simply incompatible. And I understand the desire, especially among intellectual Christians, I understand the desire to try and find a compromise. It's hard, especially for young people. I can understand. I went to a public university, okay? Portland State University, let's just say Portland State University does not have a strong campus crusade for Christ presence. We'll put it like that. And it's hard when you're surrounded by people who believe a certain way, who understand Earth's origins to be in a certain model, to fit a certain mindset or preconception. It is hard to be the only one in the room who sticks out like a sore thumb believing that the earth is just 10,000 years old. It's hard being that. It's alienating. It's isolating. So again, I understand the desire for the Christian to try and find some synthesis. Like, well, can we have Christianity and acceptance in the scientific community, broadly speaking? Can we have the best of both worlds? Two problems immediately arise, though, when you try to compromise these two things. First, God's word never needs validation from us. God isn't looking for us going, oh, I sure hope they find a way of proving Genesis 1. Oh, boy, I hope that they can use a mass spectrometer somehow to figure out how old the earth is so they'll know who I am. God's not up looking down upon us going like, oh, I sure hope they can figure out that whole Genesis 1 creation problem. God doesn't need validation from us. He doesn't care what we prove or disprove. He needs no validation from us. Whether there is definitive evidence of the immaterial or the spiritual does not matter because God can do everything. And when you concede that nothing is impossible with God, Matthew chapter 19, verse 26, then really do you need to validate God's existence? If there is nothing impossible with God, then can you say that God can create the world in 6 days in any way that He wants to and literally do it with His voice in 6 actual days? Yes. Once we concede that God can cause a worldwide flood and disrupt the languages at Babel and make wine from water and raise people from the dead, then the 6 days of creation really should not be an impediment to faith in God. Psalm 33, verses 6 and 9. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of His mouth. For He spoke, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. God's not looking for me to be some kind of a scientific advocate for His existence. The God who speaks the world into existence does not need scientific validation from us. Second problem is, even if the days of Genesis were ages, they are in an order that is altogether incongruent with Darwin's model of progressive uniform evolution. Think about things. In Genesis chapter 1, the existence of the earth precedes that of the sun. That's verse 1 and verse 16 of Genesis chapter 1. Modern thinking teaches that the sun existed for billions of years before the earth did. In Genesis, plants existed before the formation of the sun. That's verse 11. How could they have existed without the sun if the day that they were in was a billion year era? So these plants just went a billion years without any sunlight, right? It doesn't fit. plants precede insects and birds in Genesis 1. That's verses 20 through 23. Birds and insects were not created until the fifth day. So if these are billion-year eras in the days of Genesis, you have plants that existed for billions of years before pollinating insects were ever around to help them propagate. Again, it doesn't make sense. The Bible teaches that land organisms preceded aquatic life. In verses 11 and 20, evolution demands that marine life appeared before dry land organisms. The Bible teaches that whales were created before reptiles and other land animals, but evolution places whales relatively late in the evolutionary process, as they supposedly evolved from land-going mammals back to sea-going creatures. The Bible teaches that birds were created before reptiles, Genesis chapter 1, verses 20 and 24. But evolution insists that birds are the evolutionary products of the dinosaurs. So again, even if you wanted to synthesize Genesis 1 with Darwinian evolution, I'm sorry, but you can't. It's not built that way. The structure's not there. So what ends up happening, and this is the real problem, what ends up happening when a Christian tries to synthesize the Bible and its models for origins with that of Darwinian evolution, that Christian ends up being rejected by both other Christians and evolutionary scientists. Because there's a no man's land between them. There's a no man's land. You become a heretic to other Christians, and you remain as ridiculous as before. You know, there's a term out there called intelligent design, which, by the way, intelligent design is not the same as creationism. Understand that. Sometimes those terms are used synonymously by accident, by the uninformed, but intelligent design is not the same as creationism. Intelligent design is ridiculous. Because if you're not going to believe in the God of the Bible and His model for the origins of this world, you're really just grasping at straws. And you're trying to invent your own God that fits scientific preconceptions that you want to believe in desperately. So, with all this being said, does this mean that science and Genesis 1 cannot be reconciled? Are we then left with this great big problem? You can either believe in science, which I don't understand what that means. I hate it when people say it's science versus God. What does that even mean? Like science is this monolithic topic. Like science exists as this single monolithic subject. And you must fit everything into science. What does that even mean? Science versus God. Science versus the Bible. So if I want to believe in the Bible and I want to believe in God, does that mean I can't believe in science? Sir Isaac Newton would have had a real problem with that assertion because he was himself a believer in God. Uniformitarianism, I think, becomes the wedge. It's really the two-edged sword for the Darwinian evolutionist. On the one hand, evolution requires uniformitarianism. But on the other hand, uniformitarianism can be used to defeat the theories of evolution. What is uniformitarianism? Uniformitarianism is a very long word. Try saying it three times fast. I have been practicing all week. Uniformitarianism is the idea that processes that we can observe now in science have remained unchanged throughout this Earth's history. So what you can observe now, processes of science, the way things degrade, the way things grow, the way things change or evolve, etc., etc., things that you can observe now were the same way 10 billion years ago. That there is a uniformity to the way that things have worked, the way that processes have worked on this planet. There was a man named Lyell who came before Darwin. And Darwin was actually influenced heavily by Lyell, who was a geologist himself. He was not a biologist or anything. He was a geologist, and he observed in the way that geological structures and geological forms existed that there must have been some kind of uniformity to it all. And I understand what he means. Go to the Grand Canyon sometime, and you see neat little layer, neat layer,
neat layer, and you have all these tidy, neat, clean layers of sediment, one on top of the other. And you can look at these nice, tidy layers of sediment and say, well, look at this. You can measure then the earth. You can measure then processes and events based on this uniform and tidy process. Darwinian evolution was then kind of the biological offshoot of geological uniformitarianism. But I think if you put it to the test, you'll find, like I said earlier, that it's a double-edged sword. Evolution needs uniformity. It needs uniformity because it needs to see that there was a progressive, uniform process of this lower life form to a higher life form, to a higher life form, to a higher life form, and that life forms continue uniformly to become more complex. It requires uniformity in the process. Theories about the age of the earth require uniformity in the process. Can't you cut open a spruce tree, count the number of rings, and find out how old that tree is? Yes, assuming that those rings grew uniformly. Can't you cut open a rock and see the layers of sediment and make some assumptions and some theories about the age of the earth? Yes, assuming that those layers were laid uniformly. The creationist believes rather in a term called catastrophism. And catastrophism was actually the leading scientific belief in life's origins and the origins of this planet all the way up until just a few hundred years ago. And catastrophism is the idea that most of the things that we observe around us are actually the product of great catastrophes. The flood. Sorry. And catastrophism actually leads you to some very different ideas about the origins of the earth. But let's take uniformity, for example. Let's take uniformitarianism. Let's play along with the evolution. Let's just say everything that we observe now happened 10 billion years ago, or 4 billion years ago, or 10 million years ago, the same way that we can observe it now. Let's take uniformity and let's see just how old the Earth actually is. Atomic clocks. Atomic clocks measure the Earth's spin rate to the nearest billionth of a second. And atomic clocks have consistently found that the Earth is slowing down in its spin rate at a rate of almost 1 second per year. If the Earth were billions of years old, as evolutionary science claims, its initial spin rate, that is, if you take uniformitarianism and say that it has been slowing at a specific and uniform rate, and then you take that number and extrapolate backwards, you understand what I mean there? If the Earth were, in fact, 4.5 billion years old, its initial spin rate would have been so fantastically rapid that it actually would have destabilized the planet's structure. How about the magnetic field? Measurements of the Earth's magnetic field, all the way going back to 1835, show a steady and rapid decline in its strength. Physicists like Sir Horace Lamb and Dr. Thomas Barnes examined the depletion of the Earth's magnetic field, and they showed that given its rate, which is consistent, the Earth cannot possibly be older than 10,000 years old. If the magnetic field's depletion rate was consistent, again, let's take uniformitarianism at face value. If its depletion rate was consistent, only 25,000 years ago, the electrical current produced from the Earth's magnetic field would have been so great, this planet would have been uninhabitable. If you go back 30,000 years, the Earth's magnetic field would have been so intensely hot that it would have burned this planet to 5,000 degrees Celsius, which, by the way, would vaporize the planet itself. I don't know. It doesn't seem like life could have existed in 5,000 degrees Celsius on a vaporized planet. As a side effect of the... And I want to get to this point here in a minute. As a side effect of the decreasing strength of the magnetic field, by the way,
fossils that are tested now using carbon-14 dating would actually appear much older than they are. And I don't want to get into too much detail with this. I can certainly leave my notes online, and you can see some references I have for more detail on this. The way that carbon-14 dating is used to date biological fossils is that it is directly related to the amount of carbon-14 that is in our atmosphere. We'll actually talk about radiocarbon dating here in just a minute in more detail. But the amount of C14, carbon-14, in a fossil is directly related to the amount of carbon-14 that is in the atmosphere. That carbon-14 is directly related to cosmic rays that are constantly raining down upon our planet. And if you go back those 25,000, those 30,000 years, where the magnetic field of our planet would have been so strong, it actually would have prevented cosmic rays from even entering our atmosphere, which would have affected the carbon-14 in every living creature and then every fossil after that. So in a sense then, fossils that are tested using carbon-14 would have appeared much older than they actually are. Let's talk about sediment flow rate, though. Here's a staggering number. It is estimated that about 2.75 times 10 to the 10th power tons per year of sediment is being deposited into the ocean. Again, that's 2 3/4 times 10 to the 10th power tons of sediment per year. According to modern plate tectonic theories, only about 1/10 of that sediment is being subducted or buried under the Earth's tectonic plates, which leads you to wonder, where's the other 9/10 of that sediment going? If only 1/10 of that sediment is actually going somewhere under the tectonic plates, then the other 9/10 must be settling on the ocean floor. Where else would it be going? Well, if you take uniformitarianism at face value, if the Earth were as old as they say it is, then there should be far, far more sediment on the bottom of the ocean. As it is, there is about 2,950 feet of sediment on our ocean's floors. 2,950 feet. If sediment flow rate has been consistent, and I know this number doesn't gel with creationism, but consider this. If sediment flow rate has been consistent, and you take 2,950 feet of sediment and extrapolate backwards, then according to sediment flow rate, the Earth is only 30 million years old. And again, that's not the 10,000 years of a creation model, but 30 million years is a whole lot younger than 4.5 billion. The production of helium in our atmosphere. If the production of helium in our atmosphere has stayed consistent from the decay of uranium and thorium, then there is actually less than 40,000 years worth of helium gas in our atmosphere. Only 40,000 years worth of gas, only 40,000 years worth of accumulation of helium in our atmosphere. There is no known way that helium escapes our atmosphere, by the way. No known way that helium escapes our atmosphere. If the Earth were 4 billion years old, there should be more than 30 times the amount of helium in our atmosphere than there actually is. Continental erosion. Evolutionists believe the continents have existed for at least 1 billion years, and yet the rate at which continents are eroding, which is far faster than the rate at which tectonic activity is sustaining them, should mean that by now, all the continents should have been leveled. In fact, they should have been leveled 14 million years ago at the rate that they're eroding. Space dust on the moon. The moon has only inches of space dust on its surface. And yet, if it were billions of years old, it would have almost a mile of space dust accumulated on its surface. The sun is also shrinking as well. Isn't it sad? You know, when you kind of like learn some of this stuff, like, oh man, the sun is shrinking? It's kind of sad, you know? It's not going to last forever. And the Christian gets that. The rate at which the sun is shrinking in diameter is around 5 feet per hour. That's really fast. Or 0.1% each year. And this, by the way, has been confirmed by over 100 different observers since 1836. And if this rate is accurate, then only 1 million years ago, the sun would have been so large that it would have incinerated planet Earth. If the sun, again, if the rate of shrinking is consistent, then 1 million years ago, the sun would have been bigger, and it would have been so big that it would have made the Earth completely uninhabitable. It would have incinerated the Earth. Radio halos. Radio halos are small rings that you can see on microscopic fissures in crystals. And we need to remember something here about these radio halos. Now, these radio halos actually give some indication based on their color and their structure and the traces of radioactive materials within them that the Earth is quite a bit younger than it actually is. According to standard geologic timescale, the Jurassic, Triassic, and Eocene periods represent hundreds of millions of years, and yet fossils in Colorado indicate, using radio halos within those structures, that the Jurassic, Triassic, and Eocene periods were concurrent. You know, and this is the last point that we'll make. I know we're running out of time here. The last point that we'll make. I think there's enough scientific evidence that you could see, if you wanted to believe in creation, it is a valid scientific model for Earth's origins. There's a lot more that we could have talked about, but in 35 minutes, I really hate to burden you too much with the little details and everything like that. I can certainly guide you to some literature if you're interested in learning more on this subject, but I think even in just 35 minutes of a kind of a surface-level examination, you can see that you don't have to be some kind of medieval, backward-thinking dullard to believe in creation. There's a lot out there that certainly suggests to the willing heart that wants to actually listen to the evidence that the Earth is not nearly as old as science claims that it is. The last point that we'll make is this. And we touched on it earlier. Isn't it conceivable that God created the world as a fully functioning and appeared to be old planet? After all, he didn't create Adam as a little infant, did he? He created Adam as a fully functioning, fully grown adult. God did not plant saplings all over the earth. One would assume that God planted fully grown trees on the earth. God didn't place little lion cubs on planet Earth. God created this world as an aged, or at least something that appeared to be, an aged, fully mature, fully functioning, fully grown-up planet. So even if you can find evidence out there that seems to suggest that the Earth is quite old, aren't you just looking at a planet that was created, fully functioning? If you were to show up on a movie set, for example, you might see things on this movie set that appeared to be very, very old. You go to a Western period piece or something, and you're on the movie set, and you are walking around a town from 1879, and it looks very old. Because for its purpose, the creator of that movie set designed it to look appropriate. He designed it to look old because it had a function. There was a need for an old-looking set. Don't you think God could have created this planet in that same way also? Once you concede that nothing is impossible with God, it becomes very easy to accept that God can do all things and create this planet however He wants to, with the power at His disposal. If you don't want to believe in a God who created this world in 6 days, do you really have a whole lot of confidence in a God who claims to raise people from the dead? Do you really have a whole lot of confidence in a God who claims to take you to this magical wonderland called heaven? That you'll be there for all eternity after you die? I think once you stop believing in the power of God and creation, you don't have a whole lot left to believe in God's other promises and assurances. Now, if you're not a Christian here this evening, you really ought to be. This is your opportunity to make things right with God, to resolve to live for Him from this day forward. If you are so convicted, then please, whatever need you might have, come forward as we stand and sing.